Each week, American History TV sits in on a lecture with one of the nation's college professors. You can watch the classes here every Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and also Sundays at 1 p.m. Next, history professor Matthew O'Brien looks at the causes, major battles, and repercussions of World War II. Professor O'Brien examines Hitler's advance through Europe and Winston Churchill's strategy to fight the Nazis. Also discussed, the failing of the Soviet Union's non-aggression pact with Germany and the eventual full participation of the United States in the war following the attack on Pearl Harbor. This hour and 15-minute class took place at Franciscan University of Steubenville in Ohio.
Why don't we stand for a short prayer
to get us started today?
Mark, you want to lead us?
Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world of heaven. Amen.
All right, thanks, Mark. Okay, well, today we're going to talk about the Second World War. And due to the fact that we've only got about 75 minutes to cover it, we're not going to even attempt to cover the war in great detail there. Dr. Doyle teaches a course entirely devoted to the Second World War, and quite frankly, he knows more about it than I do. So we'll stick to what I know on this. But what we are going to do is we're going to look at this war through a series of very important battles there. And in doing so, we're going to talk about the myth of the Second World War. Now, that's not to say that what we're saying is untrue, but actually, in addition to covering the facts, as historians, we're also interested in how the facts are remembered, because history is about human memory as well as what happened there. So we're going to talk about the various myths of the war as they take place. We'll talk just briefly about the start of the war, the opening of the Blitzkrieg. Then we'll get into what happens in Britain with the Battle of Britain, followed by Operation Barbarossa in the Soviet Union. And then we'll talk about the American involvement in the war there. And we'll wrap things up by talking about the lessons of the war. How do these myths influence the post-war worlds here? Because you could argue that what happens in the early 1940s has repercussions that string for the rest of the century there. So while we have these three countries sharing the same side and sharing the same opponent, the way they define that opponent really helps to explain why these three countries take their own routes after the war is over. Okay. Well, to start out with, we left off on the eve of World War I with the policy of appeasement failing in Czechoslovakia. Hitler had secured the Sudetenland in the fall of 1938, and in the spring of 39, moved right in, took over Prague, and took over the rest of Czechoslovakia. In the fall of 39, on September 1st, Adolf Hitler invaded Poland. As he did so as part of a partnership with the Germans moving in from the west and the Soviets moving in from the east. This was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact there. And the Nazis steamrolled through Polish opposition. This was the Luftwaffe, the panzer tanks, fighting Polish soldiers basically on horseback. So while they did manage to put up some resistance, they were woefully outgunned and stood very little chance. It's notable that the Soviets had a more difficult time of this, that it took them longer to get through Poland. Now, they also took over the Baltic republics, and they invaded Finland as well. But the Red Army had been weakened by years of purges of its leadership there. So this was something that the Nazis would take note of later on. After absorbing Poland, Hitler stayed put for the winter of 1939. But in the spring of 1940, the Blitzkrieg moved north and then moved west. He began the spring by taking over Denmark and Norway and securing control of the Baltic Sea. And after that, moved into the Netherlands and Belgium before taking France in June of 1940. The Nazi war machine moved through France with a swiftness that even surprised the Germans. They weren't aware of the relatively easy time they would have. The French put up resistance for about 40 days, and that's it. As the Nazis moved through, almost as a result of their surprise, there was a detachment of Allied soldiers that had a chance to make it to the English Channel there. And they arrived at the beaches of Dunkirk in the northwestern corner of France. The British put out an emergency order. All ships in the North Sea were to make a beeline for Dunkirk, whether military, commercial, or even private vessels. And at Dunkirk, we got the evacuation of the remnants of the Allied army on the continent. About 300,000 soldiers picked up and brought back to Britain. In Britain, the government was facing a major transition. The British had begun the war under the leadership of Neville Chamberlain. As you might remember, it was Chamberlain who had taken up the failed policy of appeasement. It was Chamberlain who was convinced that the British could negotiate with Hitler and the Nazis. But even in the wake of that failure, the British stay with Chamberlain's leadership there. But Chamberlain compounds his earlier mistakes because Chamberlain insists that the government take direct control over British workers. Not surprisingly, in the wake of the invasion of Poland and the British declaration of war, they impose a draft on young men for the military. But the government went even a step further, and under the conservative leadership of Chamberlain, they actually insist on direct control of British workers. They argue that they should be able to direct workers, individual workers, and assign them factories there. And this has a negative effect in two ways. In the first case, Chamberlain's policies are surprisingly inefficient. Unemployment in Britain actually increases after the war starts. And on the second note, Chamberlain also alienates the British labor force itself. By asserting this control, it was as if Chamberlain was saying he didn't trust British workers to contribute to the cause there. Chamberlain's policies also gave a whiff of complacency as Chamberlain tried to tell the British people this was a case of business as usual. But eventually, by the spring of 1940, this policy of business and as usual reached its final failure. In April of 1940, when the Nazis moved north into Norway, this was a chance for the first time logistically for the British to help put up resistance. But the Nazis took Norway rather rapidly. And so after the failure at Norway, Neville Chamberlain was replaced by the Conservative Party, and there was a new prime minister in Britain. The problem for the Conservatives was that most of their leadership had been tainted by this policy of appeasement. Almost every major player had been involved and had signed off on appeasement. And in order to find somebody who was innocent of this association, the British had to reach out to the political wilderness. They had to reach out to a guy who seemed to be more of a crackpot than a reasonable leader. Winston Churchill's major military plan had been the disastrous Battle of Gallipoli in the First World War. And by the late 1930s, most people assumed that Churchill had already retired from public life. After all, he had started to write his private memoirs by that point. But in April, Churchill is the man, as out of touch as it seemed that Churchill was with the spirit of the times. Churchill was the one who power fell to. Churchill takes the evacuation at Dunkirk, an event that most people would look at as a major retreat. And Churchill manages to turn this into a rallying point for the British people. After Dunkirk, almost the entire European continent was under the control of dictators. But the way Churchill explained it, that meant that Britain was finally free of any entanglements and could fight by itself. Churchill also had a rather dry sense of humor. At one point, when Italy declares war on Britain, one of his ministers burst into his office, breathless with panic, to announce to Churchill that Italy had just declared war on Britain. Churchill's response was to shrug his shoulders and say, "It's only right. We had to fight with them on our side last time." So Churchill manages to take a new approach here. Dispensing with the complacency of business as usual, Churchill presents up front the British situation. He begins a series of nightly broadcasts on the BBC. It's estimated that about half of all British households would tune in to hear Churchill's nightly addresses to the British people there. And in those addresses, Churchill would sign a new note of resilience there. He also makes a couple fateful decisions in terms of the military. There's two different instances where the British Navy in the summer of 1940 came across sections of the French fleet. In the city of Oran in North Africa, the British Navy stumbles onto the fact that much of the French fleet under the Vichy regime, under the collaborationist government, was holed up in the harbor at Oran. Now, Churchill has a tough decision to make. The French, after all, were allies to the British just a few months before. But Churchill besieges the port and then unflinchingly orders his navy to sink the French ships, the ships of their former allies. This was a message to the British people, and it was a message to Adolf Hitler that there would be no negotiation there. And the British were left to press forward. There's a notable anecdote right around this time. The American ambassador to Britain gives an interview with the Chicago Tribune newspaper there. And the reporter from the Tribune asks the ambassador what his prediction of things is, how he thinks things will go. The American ambassador tells the Chicago Tribune writer in no uncertain terms that Britain needed to turn to negotiation. The American ambassador said that the days of the British Empire are over. In the wake of that interview, the American ambassador, Joseph Kennedy, is immediately called back to Washington. And Joseph is forced to postpone any presidential ambitions of his own. Instead, they'd fall to his son, John. But this was how grim the situation looked in the spring and summer of 1940. In August, Hitler comes to the decision that he would begin an aerial bombardment of Britain. He would fly the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, over Britain, carefully selecting industrial targets. He'd go after airfields, factories, train stations, and try to bomb those with the hope that he would be able to bomb the British people into submission. Initially, in the first month or so, this Operation Eagle is quite successful. The German Air Force is larger than the British Air Defense, than the Royal Air Force, and it's also better equipped. Yes, I see. That was another instance where the British fleet sank French ships off the coast of Dakar there. Yeah. Well, with the first few weeks of Operation Eagle, the Nazi Air Force performed almost flawlessly. the German planes shooting down more British planes than vice versa, and hitting their targets fairly accurately. But here's where Churchill's unorthodox view came into place once again. Because aircraft had been perfected as an offensive weapon, there wasn't that much that could be done in terms of defense. And against all odds, Churchill orders a group of British pilots to fly over to the continent and bomb Berlin. The British planes actually make it into Germany. And while they don't do much material damage, symbolically, this infuriates Hitler. He's outraged. He declares that the British have broken protocol by bombing a civilian target, conveniently forgetting what Hitler had done to the Poles just the previous fall. But ignoring the advice of his generals, Hitler insists that the Luftwaffe should shift targets rather than bombing these factories, these industrial sites. Hitler argues that the Luftwaffe should just bomb major cities. This is the worst months of the Battle of Britain. London was bombed 69 nights in a row. Glasgow was bombed, even Belfast in Northern Ireland. But in doing so, in ignoring the advice of his generals and the warnings of his generals, Hitler played right into Churchill's hands. The British understood that the German planes were going to be coming like clockwork every night. And they managed to pool their anti-aircraft resources, their guns, their planes. They even used the recent invention of radar. And within a month or two, the Germans were starting to lose the Battle of Britain. By the spring of 1941, the Germans were forced to call off Operation Eagle and abandon plans for an invasion of Britain. In the meantime, Churchill issued some of the most famous rhetoric in British history. If you take a look at this quote, you'll see that he's not offering a comforting message here. It's pure inspiration. He's portraying the worst case scenario. When the Nazis show up, this is how we're going to fight them. 180 degrees difference from what Chamberlain had said in the fall of 1939. World War II would become known and become defined in Britain as the People's War. Churchill would praise the RAF, declaring that never have so many owed so much to so few. But at the same time, Churchill would also argue that it's the British people who are winning this war. The workmen are soldiers with different weapons, but the same courage. Unlike World War I, where there was a home front and a battle front, in Britain, these two things were the same. And later on, people would look back during these years, even during the height of the Blitz, with a kind of romantic appreciation of what was taking place. This was a trial, but the German bombing seemed almost a matter of amusement there, rather than a grave threat to their survival. The heroes in Britain are the survivors. They're the people who slept in the subway at night to come back up and work during the day. Queen Elizabeth, as a young woman, as a princess, in many ways redeems the British monarchy by touring bombing sites. There were advisors who had told the royal family to clear out of Britain, go somewhere safe where the Nazis couldn't reach. But Queen Elizabeth and her family stayed put, and in doing so, offered a kind of symbolic leadership that really brought this country together. As well, Churchill took a new approach to politics. Now, we talked about Churchill existing in the political wilderness in the late 1930s because he had opposed appeasement. But Churchill wasn't the only person out there. He was the most notable conservative member. But Churchill was actually in a rather unlikely partnership with British trade unions. in the late 30s, because Union leaders had objected to Hitler and to appeasement as well, on the basis of what Hitler was doing to German workers. So after he comes to the position of prime minister, Churchill plays up this element of desperation, of sacrifice, and he reaches across the political divide to bring these labor leaders into his government. For the British, as I mentioned, they see this as the people's war, and the way they define the Nazis is as a power state, as this awesome force there, but a force that's going to use its power against the people rather than for it. For the British, they would argue that the government is meant to look after the welfare of the people rather than merely offer power. Churchill brings in a man named Ernest Bevin, a trusted leader in the British organized labor community. And Bevin is given the responsibility to draw up a labor budget to figure out which British workers are needed for which industries there. Rather than rely on compulsion and force the way Chamberlain had, Bevin offers inducements. He doesn't force people into factories, but instead appeals to a volunteer patriotism. And here's the surprising result of that. Now, when we think of the Nazis, we think of a very top-down, order-driven society, oftentimes very efficient, we would assume. But actually, when you look at the way that the Nazis use their labor force, only about 30% of the German adult workforce worked in industry during this time. Now, in part, that was because the Nazis had assigned women maternal duties exclusively. They had kept them at home to go and raise up new young Nazis there. But while the Nazis only got 30% of their workforce, by the end of the war, the British have 70% of all adults working in these factories, much more efficiently than the Nazis. Again, by appealing to this volunteer patriotism rather than compulsion. As they do so, as they demonstrate the efficiency of this planning, Bevin and other members of the labor community offer an alternative to the power state. They argue that what Britain has, the strength of Britain, it's a term most American politicians would run away screaming from, but the British argue that it's the welfare state that's going to mobilize this nation. So when housewives go off to work in the factories, the state steps up and the government offers childcare. The government offers improved medical care and improved nutrition as well. Over the course of the Second World War, while the Nazis are bombing overhead, infant mortality rates decline in Britain. Nutrition rates improve in Britain because of this. This is the time of great test, and the welfare state seems capable of answering that test. Another important difference that the British make from the First World War is that at the beginning of the First World War, everybody expected that it would go maybe a couple months. So the government took out loans. This time, in 1940, with the Battle of Britain raging, the government understands it can't borrow money. It needs to raise taxes. And it does raise tax rates quite high. But you can be assured that while the Luftwaffe was strafing British cities, people weren't complaining about tax rates. There were more immediate concerns on their mind. And this is a fundamental difference in outlook between Britain and the United States, even to this day. As Americans were concerned with taxes, in Britain, they're concerned about services. If their National Health Service is operating, that's their primary concern. Whether they have to pay for it comes after the notion of whether it's effective. As I said, by the spring of 1941, Hitler is forced to abandon his plans to take over Britain. And it's at this point that the Nazi war machine shifts from the West back to the East. Now, we talked about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, this very surprising alliance between Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler. This was announced in August of 1939, and it shocked everyone who was looking at this. The Nazis and the communists were supposed to be polar opposites of each other. Hitler had come to power by making German communists out to be this major threat. But instead, we see that when this pact is announced, that Stalin is surprisingly trustful of the Nazis in ways that really come back to open the Soviets up for an invasion. The Soviets agree not just to divide Poland, but they also agree to provide Germany with war materials, materials like steel, rubber, oil, precisely the necessities that the Nazis need for their army. By the spring of 1941, the Germans had even gotten behind in their payments, but the Soviets continued to send these materials over to them. As well, by the spring of 1941, there were outside sources warning Stalin about what Hitler was doing. There were American and British intelligence officers who were able to tell Stalin that the Germans were moving troops from the West to the East. But Stalin chose to ignore those warnings. Well, when the Germans open up Operation Barbarossa, there are also internal problems in the Red Army. Stalin had gone through the officer corps, sending so many of the soldiers to Siberia that there was a culture within the army where people were afraid to offer any kind of criticism, no matter how mild, to Comrade Stalin. The penalty for offering such criticism would be to be accused of defeatism, which meant a one-way train ticket to Siberia. So the Soviets embark on a series of very unwise policies. When they take over eastern Poland, they don't even put up defensive fortifications. They leave things wide open. And when Hitler moves in June of 1941, he's able to make inroads of hundreds of miles in just a matter of days. Let me provide you with some of the numbers of how heavily the Nazis destroyed the Red Army. The Nazis would use non-German troops as well from Eastern Europe as they pushed forward. But the Nazis would fight with a new policy, a Vernichtungskrieg. Any German scholars out there want to try their hand at a translation? All right. Well, this is a war without mercy. Unlike in the Western Front, in the war against Britain and France, the war against the Soviets for the Germans was a race war. It was a war where prisoners were not to be taken, instead executed. And so the fighting that takes place in the Eastern Front with Operation Barbarossa reaches a ferocity that's never equaled in the West. The Soviets are unprepared, and the German Luftwaffe that leads this assault destroys much of the Soviet Air Force before it even takes off, quite literally.
So Germany turned on Russia?
That's right. In June of 1940, the Soviets lose 3,200 planes, much of their air force. They lose 95% of their tanks. And in the opening weeks, they lose 320,000 troops. This creates such a panic that Stalin himself disappears for 2 weeks after this is invaded. The Germans move in. One German marshal will declare that Operation Barbarossa has been won in 2 weeks. And the Germans would make their way in 500 miles within 2 months. Eventually, the Germans would reach further into Russia than Napoleon had during his campaign in the early 19th century. By the end of it, we had 3 million Soviet POWs, most of whom died of exposure or starvation over the course of the first winter. The Nazis seemed to demonstrate a kind of cruel pleasure. They would round up Soviet POWs and within fences and throw loaves of bread over into the crowds to see who would fight whom for the last scrap of bread. And eventually, the Nazis would reach all the way up to Leningrad and besiege the city of Leningrad for longer than 2 years. Any questions on all this? Yes, Casey.
You said they went 500 miles into Russia. What's the overall width of Russia? Is there a mileage?
Well, we're talking about an expansive country, certainly. By August, they were about halfway to Moscow there. But in taking this, the Soviets were so ill-prepared that there seemed to be no resistance, that the Germans could drive as fast as they could into this place. Yeah. Well, after his initial panic, Stalin regained his footing in the Soviet Union. He restored many of the officers that he had purged, at least those who had survived their winters in Siberia are brought back, and they're pressed into service in the Red Army. He also demonstrates a kind of personal determination. Stalin's son served in the Red Army as a private, and at one point, the Soviets managed to capture a high-ranking German official in the Wehrmacht. The Germans made an offer to Joseph Stalin. They would exchange prisoners. They would give Stalin his own son back if the Soviets would just let this officer go. Stalin flatly refuses. He declares that he would not give up a corporal, the German officer, for a private, even knowing that that meant his son would probably not survive that winter. This is Stalin's determination. Stalin appeals to the old days of the Russian Empire. A lot of the Russian nationalism that the communists had attempted to get rid of, Stalin restores. Stalin orders his favorite film director, a director named Sergei Eisenstein, to make a movie about a medieval Russian leader, Ivan the Terrible. Now, Ivan, as his name might suggest, was a man with a considerable reputation for brutality, abusing his own people, but also a leader who had defended Russia against the Mongol hordes. In making this movie, Stalin models himself after Ivan. Stalin would relax a lot of the restrictions and the censorship on traditional Russian institutions, loosening up control of the Russian Orthodox Church, for instance. But at the same time, using this nationalism to build up a stronger sense of resistance. And Stalin would embark on a massive industrial project. Stalin would order over 500 factories in Western Russia to be taken apart, brought across the Ural Mountains into Siberia, and reassembled in Siberia. This was a project that oftentimes meant dynamiting the tundra to build the foundation of these new factories. One that surely would have intimidated almost any other leader. But remember that Stalin was the man who had brought the first five-year plan to the Soviet Union in the first place. So he seemed eminently capable of embarking on such a project. Stalin would define this war, if it was the People's War in Britain, in Russia, it was the Great Patriotic War. And it was a war that is remembered as being won under Stalin's leadership. So this is the Soviet interpretation. Probably the best remembered battle that takes place. You can see some of the images of the babushka calling forward Russian men and women to fight. Another measure of dedication as the Stalinist propaganda machine was revved up for the war. Well, probably the battle that the Soviets see as the turning point took place at Stalingrad, beginning in 1942. After the Germans had made their way so far into the Soviet Union, Hitler orders soldiers to be detached and to move southward, to be moved for the oil fields of the Caucasus. Hitler needed petroleum for the war machine. The city of Stalingrad stood on the Volga River, right to the west of these oil fields. It seemed to control these oil fields. And so at Stalingrad, the leader of the Soviet Union orders his troops to make a final stand.
Is Stalingrad on Leningrad too?
No, Leningrad, St. Petersburg in the north was renamed Leningrad. Stalingrad's in the south there. At Stalingrad, the Soviets lose more people than the American armed forces lose during the entirety of the Second World War. Not only are the numbers drastic there, but also the measures taken. Stalin makes a famous order known colloquially as the Not a Step Back order, in which he creates what are known as blocking divisions. He orders these Soviet soldiers into battle against the Nazis. But after these soldiers had moved out, Stalin commissions a group of irregular soldiers, oftentimes older people, women, sometimes bringing people in from Siberia. He outfits them with guns, and he tells these blocking divisions that they should arrest or, if necessary, shoot anyone coming their way, German or Soviet. Soviet soldiers would not be permitted to retreat in Stalingrad. The battle's brutal. It goes on for months. But in the end, the Soviets break the Nazi siege, and they begin to push the Nazis back to the west. If you talk to someone in Britain, it's the Battle of Britain that's the turning point. Someone in Britain would say, quite accurately, that it's the first time that the Nazis are forced to give up on something. The Soviets would argue that Stalingrad is even more important because it's the first time that the Germans are forced to retreat. And as I said, the way this is portrayed is by Stalin's officers, including many men who Stalin had actually once sent to Siberia through the purges. The bitterness that exists in the Soviets as they push back is partly an effect of this Vernichtungskrieg, this race war that took place. And so by the time that the Soviets push through Eastern Europe and even into Eastern Germany, they view this as a retribution. If the Nazis didn't take prisoners, the Soviets weren't going to either. The Soviets would also see many of the other Eastern European peoples who had joined the Nazis in Operation Barbarossa as fair game. Right? Any questions on this? As we're moving through. Yes, Chris.
When they were moving the factories in Siberia, about how far was that?
That was a span of several hundred miles crossing mountains as they went. So this was a pretty intimidating process. Yes, yes, Casey.
Did they literally take the factories like apart piece by piece and took everything with them?
They did. They would dismantle them, then bring them usually by train across the Urals. Yeah. And rebuild them there. Right. Any other questions? Yes, Mary.
Why did the Soviets like order to shoot on their own people, like on their own soldiers? How did that help them?
Because World War II, there were a lot of cases of desertion. And this was the Soviet response to desertion. You follow orders. It goes back to the days of the Tsarist regime. But there's not a whole lot of room for discussion or dissension at this point. The Soviets are literally on the edge of being knocked out. And so Stalin declares he sacrificed his own son. He expects nothing less of anybody else involved in this. Any other questions there? Yes, Casey. You can go first, Mark.
Is Germany fighting a two-front war at this point?
At this point, they had pretty much sewn up Western Europe. They had taken over France, set up a collaborationist state. And so the Soviets are really, there's battles taking place in North Africa, but the Soviets are really on their own there. Now later, after the war is over, this would be a case for Soviet bitterness towards the Western powers as well. They would argue that the Western powers of Britain and the United States took their sweet time to get involved in this war. Now, Churchill offers to start a second front to alleviate some of the pressure there, but Churchill wants to move through the Balkans, and the Soviets won't let him start a second front that close to the Eastern Front, because they want to make sure when they move through Eastern Europe that they, in their eyes, they clean this area up. They liquidate any resistance so they wouldn't see this again. But yeah. The Western Front in D-Day is something that's postponed repeatedly before it's finally launched in June of 44. There. Moving on to the American War there. It's significant the United States, obviously, if you ask someone in the U.S. when the war began, I think most of us would probably say 1941 there. But not only was the United States relatively late in entering the war, there was also quite substantial opposition to entering the war right up to Pearl Harbor. Even opposition to granting the British some military assistance as well. You see some of the isolationist cartoons of the time that were offered here as the Titanic made its way through these icebergs there, these threats to American independence. And it's oftentimes forgotten just how widespread isolationism was. In part, this came from a sense of disillusionment with the First World War. At the end of the war, the Americans were not just disappointed, but even traumatized to find that they had fought so hard for nothing but to prop up these old regimes there. So there's a great bitterness that comes out. The failure of the League of Nations is also seen as another argument against helping or getting involved in another European war. And there's a movement known as America First that eventually would draw hundreds of thousands of members. This is just one isolationist group, but it's a group that included Gerald Ford, who would later on become the American president. Even a young John F. Kennedy writes a letter to America First saying that he supports this cause of keeping the U.S. out of the war. So we find they have numbers and they have influence. There's a Gallup poll taken about entering the war in 1937. And by a two-thirds majority, people are arguing that the United States should not get involved. Well, when the Americans do get involved with Pearl Harbor, the mood turns 180 degrees. Isolationist groups almost immediately disband. Within a number of days, America First has broken up, and people are now fully involved in the war. But as they do so, there's an interesting point about the way the Americans define their enemy. If I had to ask you, when we think about the Nazis, as the Nazis are portrayed in most movies, how would you describe them there? What do you think? For an American, what?
Hard-nosed, ruthless.
Okay, ruthless. Kind of guys. Okay, almost robotic there.
Yeah.
And what do they believe in? As Americans, what do we think they believe in? What's the thing that we really object to? What do you think?
Like anti-Semitism and Aryan superiority.
Yeah, yeah. We define them by their racial views. Now, the British would define them by abusing the workers there. The Soviets would see them as a kind of a form of capitalism. But for Americans, we focus on Nazi racial ideology. And that's very significant there. Because as we go up to fight against these Nazis, we set up American patriotism as the exact opposite. If you've seen any World War II movie, The Dirty Dozen, Force 10 from Navarone, even Saving Private Ryan, one of the things you'll notice is there is a kind of stock group of ethnic characters involved. It's as if every regiment in the Second World War had a Jewish guy from Brooklyn, had an Irish guy from Boston, had a sharpshooter, a sniper, oftentimes from the South or Appalachia, and even had African-American guys in there, Jim Brown and the Dirty Dozen there. Anybody know when the American Armed Forces desegregated?
Vietnam? I thought that
it wasn't quite that late.
It was the first unified.
Well, there's an order for desegregation signed, but it's signed in 1948, not during the war. Black soldiers didn't fight alongside white soldiers. Now, this was a matter of contention in Britain when the American soldiers show up. The British are surprised that black soldiers aren't given the same barracks as white soldiers. But there's a larger message that comes out of our memory of this war. And that's that in defining ourselves against racism, that racism becomes not only negative, but it becomes unpatriotic there. And so we have a slew of ideas that come out. We'll come back to D-Day in just a minute. But this is what the Nazis want to do. They want to come over and hit our churches. So as Americans, when we respond, this is an Irish tavern owner with a bunch of British sailors. The Irish and British, not known for necessarily getting along before this, but now they both want to fight the Nazis there. And so this is a way for people to look over their racial or their ethnic divisions. And if you pay attention in the movies, what happens oftentimes is that the American forces are actually superior to the Germans because they have different religious or ethnic groups involved in them. Our differences make us stronger. So we take Nazi propaganda and we flip it in reverse there. This sailor here was Dory Miller. Anybody ever hear of Dory Miller before? He was a cook at Pearl Harbor, who, when the Japanese plane started to strafe, Dory Miller jumped up and grabbed a gun and started to shoot Japanese planes down there. This is an argument that racial segregation, Jim Crow, can exist because it's unpatriotic. And here's another poster coming out of this notion of American races coming together. This was an important point in African American history because you had quite a few African Americans moving north into cities for the first time. There were riots, race riots, that would break out occasionally, including some as far north as Detroit. But in the reaction against these riots, the government argued that anyone who couldn't work alongside someone from another race was not only ignorant, but they were unpatriotic. If you don't like to work next to black guys, you must like Hitler then, because Hitler believes the same thing. And this is what we're fighting against. This has a very strong long-term effect. Joe Louis, the American heavyweight champion, brought in for propaganda shots and brought into the army. So another group here, it's not to say that racial tolerance was uniform across the United States. Certainly racial segregation still persisted in the South. And probably the most egregious shortcoming in this rhetoric came in the treatment of Japanese Americans. This is a picture of the 442nd combat team. Anybody ever hear of the 442nd before? Anybody know what they did?
They go and fight in Italy and whatnot, and you know, there was a division from Texas that was surrounded in the mountains, and then they would, you know, free them from the Waffen SS.
That's right. These were the most highly decorated military unit in the Second World War, and one of the most highly decorated in American military history. Do you know where they were from? There. Where they were recruited from?
I'm going to say Kansas, but...
They're predominantly Japanese American. And a lot of them were actually recruited from internment camps. So this is the message being sent, that all groups should be brought in. Whether they were, that's a matter of debate, and it was certainly incomplete. But the message is there. On D-Day, on June the 6th, 1944, American soldiers land, and I think for most of us Americans, that's when we see the war really beginning to turn. Militarily, the Western Front is opened, and the Western Allies make their way into Germany there. And they do so with considerable resistance. There are serious problems. The Battle of the Bulge, the Germans put up a kind of surprising amount of resistance. But eventually, by the spring of 1945, the Allies were knocking on the doors in Berlin. But again, this message of unity, of coming together, persisted. Now, as I mentioned, it's incomplete, and there's an awareness of this. There's an awareness of that the country could be even better if people could come together. So Arthur Upham Pope's message is that racism is the next obstacle to be tackled there. But if we want to achieve national greatness, this is what needs to be done. Right? Any questions on this as we move through? Yes,
so if
Mark?
They're promoting so much racial integration during World War II, why did that all stop like in the 50s?
Well, I think they're promoting it there. And this is certainly something that's not going to happen overnight. But I think this lends a kind of credibility to the cause of desegregation there. There had been opposition to segregation. People had misgivings about racial segregation for a long time there. But World War II as a national experience finally says this is not only wrong, it's unpatriotic. And it redefines the American identity as well. For most of the 19th and even the early 20th century, many Americans would argue that the American national identity is really kind of a watered-down British identity there. There are some people who would argue that that immigration's a big factor and that different backgrounds are good, but they're in the minority there. But it's really the force of this and the momentum reached in World War II, where finally African Americans can call the bluff of people who would uphold Jim Crow and argue that they were good enough to carry weapons over in Europe. Why can't they have the same rights? Why can't they vote in the South? There. So, yeah.
Did this anti-racism in America have any influence on other countries?
Were there any countries
Europe.
Okay. Well, in Europe, actually, one of the things we find is that there wasn't so much a problem with racism in Europe. I mean, there was racial prejudice that existed, but it wasn't institutionalized outside of Germany in the same way. So it's more popular attitudes. But I guess if you wanted to talk about racism in the context of the empires at war, France and Britain both use a lot of colonial soldiers there. And after the war, a lot of these colonial soldiers decide they want to immigrate permanently to Britain and France. And the attitude, there's a more accepting attitude, because after all, these people just fought under the same flag. So there's an appreciation there. Yeah. All right. Any other questions there? Okay. Well, let's talk about the lessons derived from this experience then, and how these echo into the late 1940s, even the 50s. And for the first part, we'll go back to Britain. And we said in Britain this was the people's war, that Winston Churchill even acknowledged that it's everyday people who won this war for Britain, people who showed up and continued to go to work despite the destruction and the danger. So for the British, after the war, they really look back upon this with voluntary patriotism and these wartime programs put into effect. You know, in the United States, we have this idea of the greatest generation, right? It's almost a kind of veneration of the men and women who had fought in the Second World War there. And there's a respect given there. And for Britain, that respect extends to the leaders at the same time. So that people like Bevin and Churchill, and even the civil servants who were involved in organizing this, really pick up on this message. So the British government decides to continue the welfare state. It's not merely as a kind of reward to the German people for what they had done, but also out of the conviction that this is Britain at its best. This is when Britain is most efficient, most effective, is when their government displays a concern for its people there. And so this is how they see the welfare state. In the wake of World War II in the late 40s, the British institute the National Health Service. They expand their education. They expand their nutrition programs. And they see this as a rather British contract between the government and the people. It's a source of pride for them. Now, later on in the 1970s, late 70s, Margaret Thatcher will come along, as we'll talk about later on, and she'll try to tweak things a little bit. But she knows better than to take on the major pillars. Margaret Thatcher's political career comes to a crashing halt when she tries to take on the National Health Service there. And so when you see displays on this, even in conversations with people in Britain, there are times where you find people would complain about the wait to get into clinics or something like that. But you don't find people complaining about the cost. It's service rather than cost that's their major concern. And this is something they believe that was introduced in the Second World War and has continued on since then. Well, in Britain, part of this is to do with a report that was drawn up in 1942. By the spring of 1942 in Britain, there's a surprising feeling of triumph. Having withstood Operation Eagle, the British still have to deal with the harassment of aerial bombing. Nowadays, I think you and I might view it as something more serious than harassment, but for them, they had figured out that Hitler's reach couldn't make it over the English Channel. And so they immediately put people to work with trying to figure out how to continue these services after the war. Now, in World War I, you'll remember we had David Lloyd George offering these programs of homes for heroes, right? Does anybody remember what happened to these homes for heroes?
There wasn't enough funding, so they sort of just were like sprawling wastelands.
That's right. There's not enough funding. So at the end of the war, As the writer T.E. Lawrence says, they're politely told to go sit down and let the old men take over there. Well, this is taken up during the war by people within the British government on the conviction that they're not going to be told to sit down again. They're going to draw up plans. These plans are put under the leadership of Sir William Beveridge. Beveridge was known as a rather difficult individual, a bureaucrat within the British government. And the idea was to give Beveridge the kind of Gordian knot of bringing together life insurance, unemployment insurance, medical care, education, with the hope that this would keep Mr. Beveridge busy for the next 3 or 4 years and keep him out of the hair of anybody in government. But Beveridge turns around and puts this together in just over a year. 1943, Beveridge comes out with a parliamentary blue book labeled Social Insurance and Allied Services. Now, for those of you who have never taken up a parliamentary blue book to read, they usually offer the same kind of excitement you might get from reading the instruction manual of your DVD player there. But when this comes out in Britain, it attracts widespread support. It argues for expanding these wartime programs. There's a survey done just several weeks after its release. 95% of everyone interviewed in Britain says that they've heard of this report or even read parts, and 90% of the British people approve of it. It's overwhelmingly successful in Britain. Now, this coincides, this notion of a welfare state, coincides after the war with the similar feeling. Here's the British soldier with his mug of Social Security by William Beveridge. On the continent, there's also a similar movement there. On the continent, those countries faced even a more difficult situation after 1945. For us Americans, it's the Germans versus the Allies, fairly clear-cut. You're in one group or the other. But as Hitler, as Mussolini, as these other dictators took over these countries, they implicated a lot of non-party members as well. So after the war, there's considerable soul-searching in France, as well as in Italy and Germany. Even in the Netherlands, people are trying to figure out what it meant to collaborate with the Nazis and what it meant to resist them. It's not exactly clear-cut. But these new countries after 1945 are concerned about setting up their government. How far do they have to go to make sure that their new leaders weren't implicated with the Nazis or with the fascists? The major political movement that comes out of this is one called Christian democracy. And in Italy, in Germany, in France, we find that these movements pluck people out who set up this notion of the welfare state, arguing for a greater social responsibility. But they also, these leaders also come out of a Catholic background. Their primary motivating document is Rerum Novarum. They've seen what can go wrong when a state operates without this sense of concern for everyone. And so this contributes greatly to European thought and the European welfare state up to this very day. They argue that what they pursue is a third way. Capitalism as far as possible, socialism as much as necessary. That is their safety net, and they take it very seriously. For the Soviets, the line they draw is that Comrade Stalin needs to be followed. They conveniently forget about Stalin's purges of the Red Army. That is hushed up, censored, excluded. But instead, Stalin's leadership is seen as crucial to winning the war. And so after the war, Stalin's authority would be even further advanced. Stalin reinitiates the purges. Sometimes he even goes after the successful officers from the Second World War. Many of them go back to Siberia. But nonetheless, this is how the Soviets understand. This was a drastic time. There was a very moving documentary that went back in the 80s, and they interview members of the blocking divisions. They ask these people, well, the same question Mary posed. How do you reconcile this? How do you feel when you were given a gun, told to march into battle and fire on anyone who comes back to you? And they argue, these were orders. Orders are orders. And after all, we did defeat the Nazis, right? And so this is reinforced. So we see Lenin and the party credited as well as Comrade Stalin. There's also an element of bitterness among the Soviets that we'll talk about in our next class, because they do see the British and the Americans as really dragging their heels on ending this war and even opening up a second front. And for the United States, we come back to this notion of ethnicities, races, religions coming together to make a stronger composite group. This element of pluralism, these differences make us stronger rather than weaker. After all, it's said with great ridicule, Hitler had argued that the United States would roll over after Pearl Harbor. He declared that the Americans couldn't offer much resistance because, in his words, they were half Judaicized, half Negrified. But he certainly was proven wrong in the eyes of the Americans after this. So the ideal we hold up is a notion of a nation of immigrants. With the civil rights movement. Now, talking about even Judaism, one of the things we often forget is that anti-Semitism was a serious problem in this country on the eve of the Second World War. In one survey conducted in 1938, one of the things we find when asked about whether Jews had a role in their persecution in Germany, that only about 10% would say it's all the fault of the Jews, but almost half would argue that it was at least partly the fault of the Jews there. That's rather disconcerting. Well, let me show one of the films that comes out of the propaganda files from the Second World War that offers a chance to address anti-Semitism, this time with the dulcet tones of Frank Sinatra. This was effectively a public service announcement that won, was awarded a special Oscar in 1946.
Look, fellas, religion makes no difference, except maybe to a Nazi or somebody as stupid. Why, people all over the world worship God in many different ways. God created everybody. He didn't create one people better than another. Your blood's the same as mine. Mine's the same as his. Do you know what this wonderful country is made up? It's made up of 100 different kind of people and 100 different ways of talking and 100 different ways of going to church. But they're all American ways. Wouldn't we be silly if we went around hating people because they combed their hair different than ours? Wouldn't we be a lot of dopes? My dad came from Italy, but I'm an American. But should I hate your father because he came from Ireland or France or Russia? Wouldn't I be a first-class fathead?
You get the story. Frank then goes, sings a patriotic song in which he talks about the United States and the way in which it's a haven for everyone. And this is what matters, that people have the freedom to follow their religions. Now, we can also see this important in an ethnic sense. As an Irish-American historian, we see that the Irish are really elevated after the war. You have movies like Yankee Doodle Dandy come out. You have Audie Murphy, the most decorated soldier of the Second World War. You have people who had previously been seen as a little bit strange, maybe prone to fighting, drinking, kind of disreputable stuff. But now they're cleaned up, as they're portrayed here. One of the most famous examples of this is Bing Crosby, whose movie Going My Way offers him as a kind of Irish Catholic priest. It draws a lot of non-Catholics to the movies there. This is kind of the new wave of American cinema in the late 40s. Are these Catholics who are shown in this wholesome approach there? Bing Crosby's this young priest. He's different from the old ones. Barry Fitzgerald here is speaks with a brogue, not quite as assimilated, but it's an effort to redefine what it meant to be Catholic and to be Irish Catholic. And it winds up winning 7 Academy Awards that year as it's recognized, and this larger theme is recognized. There's even some other ditties that come into place during the war and after the war, explaining that there can be differences among ethnics, but these differences shouldn't take away from their patriotic credentials. So there's a song about Thomas Jeffersky, that a ski, a wits, an offer, a coup, when added to a name, just teaches us the family or town from where it came. So these things aren't strange. They aren't unpatriotic. And actually, when you look at it, they're more patriotic. This is the nation of immigrants that really comes into place. There's a bunch of songs that come out with this same spirit there. Now, at this point in the late 40s, for American Catholics, we also have a major government program that comes out, a few of them. The biggest one is the GI Bill. The GI Bill. Anybody know when this school was started?
1946.
That's right. No coincidence there. The GI Bill allowed Catholic Americans who had gone to grade school and gone to high school, oftentimes very good high schools, to make the leap into higher education. Generationally, for the first time. Now, for me, it was my parents. For you, probably your grandparents. But if you ask your grandparents, if you can, about what it meant for them to go to college, they'll tell you it was a huge step up. It was a way that they could be admitted to the middle class in a way that was denied them before that. So we have other pluralism ditties. You can get good milk from a brown-skinned cow. The color of its skin doesn't matter, no how. The color of your skin doesn't matter to me. This notion, Columbus coming from a Spanish background, Lafayette from French, all chipping in there. And these people sharing the same blood. Lastly, we can talk about this as really introducing, certainly not solving, Mark, as your question got out, not solving racial differences, but introducing them on a new level there. Because with the elevation of desegregation to a kind of patriotic cause, that drew many people in who had previously seen this as not their fight there. Now it was a fight. It was about American national identity. And it was crucial for national greatness that we achieve that. Part of this draws in from what's known as the Double V campaign. Among African-American leaders, they began to call for an equal treatment, for getting rid of the hypocrisy. Because Jim Crow now just wasn't derogatory, it was hypocritical. After all, that's what we fought the Nazis over there. So this comes into place. This is a march actually taking place in Pittsburgh. But you'll see, race discrimination breeds fascism. This is the way for Americans. This is the lesson of World War II. This is the direction we need to move in. All right? So in summary, we talk about the different directions of these countries deriving the lesson from the myth of the Second World War. In Britain, the direction that they would move in is a state that looks after its people rather than just controlling them. For the Soviets, the direction they would hold is to group the people under Stalin's control even further. And for the Americans, the direction they had was not only to acknowledge pluralism, but celebrate it as a national strength. All right? So the next time you see a serviceman, you can thank him for defending your freedom, but also thank him for offering you the opportunities that you have now. All right. We'll see you next Tuesday afternoon. Yes, Mike. Oh, sure. You had a question about what?
I didn't get them copied down.
Oh, you know what? I emailed the text of the lecture, and I also the IDs I emailed out to you already, so you have those. Yeah. You too. Okay. We'll see. All right. We'll see.
Join us each Saturday at 8 p.m. and midnight Eastern, and Sundays at 1 p.m. for classroom lectures from across the country on different topics and eras of American history. Lectures in history are also available as podcast. Visit our website at cspan.org/history/podcast or download them from iTunes.